here in the middle of nowhere. She thinks she can break the cuffs. Still, the ease and confidence with which he approaches her ignites a fire deep in her belly.
"Fucking gave you an order, bitch," Thor's saying. "Clear as fucking day, I gave you an order to pull over, and what did you fucking do? What did you fucking do, huh, bitch?"
The Daniel and Abigail Bannings of the world are few and far between, thank God. But men like this one, men who will run you off the road because they have cast you in their paranoid fantasies, are far more common. And the tyranny of their appetites is so woven through every woman's world that imagining life without it is the same as imagining life without ground underfoot.
"Don't you fucking move. Got it, bitch?" Thor snarls.
There's about a foot of space between them now. He's going to step behind her to cuff her wrists. His friend raises his shotgun.
"We can either have a nice long conversation about what the hell you're doing all the way out here, or Axel can put a load of buckshot in you and save us all the trouble."
Axel is a silhouette backlit by the headlight from his bike. But his aim looks steady. Thor's behind her now. "I live out here." Her voice sounds vacant, numb.
"Oh yeah? You snake?"
He grabs the back of her hair and pulls it like a leash. It should hurt. He wants it to hurt. But it doesn't.
"I said, are you a fucking snake, bitch?"
"Get off me," she says.
"What?"
"I said get off me."
"You don't give me orders, you stupid fucking cunt."
A few seconds later, he's careening toward his friend like a drunken idiot trying to dance at a wedding reception. It wasn't the most complex of moves on her part. Just a pull of his arm and a thrust, really. But the strength she put behind it is otherworldly. It's like a blast of air has sent him hurtling through the dark toward Axel's shotgun. There was no preparing for it. Axel, it turns out, is too prepared. There's an explosion of light and a deafening boom. Drifts of torn denim snowflake through the air in front of her. Over the ringing in her ears, she hears Axel bellowing as he realizes he's just blown a hole in his friend. Thor's drop is decisive and sudden. Before Axel can raise the shotgun again, she runs for him, hands out, gives him what would have been a light shove just hours before. He hurtles backward into the bars of his Harley-Davidson. The impact of his spine cracks the headlight. The shotgun hits the dirt. He and the bike fall over to one side together, their dark silhouette like a time-lapse of melting snow. The ringing in her ears drowns out the sounds he's making now. But if his spread arms, trembling hands, and shaking head are any indication, they're probably stomach-churning, and she's willing to bet he'll never walk again. There's a cold caress around her ankles. Her stopping power punched shallow holes in the ground. When she steps out of them, the holes widen, chunks of caked desert earth tumbling off her sneakers. There should be regret, she knows. Somewhere within her there should be some primal remorse. But the music in her bones is at a fever pitch now, and so vivid are the nightmare images of what these two men might have done to her out here, they white out all her other thoughts. And there was a glimpse of something, just a glimpse in Axel's eyes before he cracked the bike's headlight with his spine. A glimpse of something that satisfied a thirst in her she didn't know she possessed. Fear. There's no sign of the biker she hit with her car. Did they leave him for dead, or is he crawling back to their hideout to get help? How many of them are there? The darkness seems to close in around her now. The thought of digging in their pockets for their phones sends a rush of revulsion through her that makes her feel suddenly ordinary again. Do they have satellite phones? They're well outside the boosters at her house that could provide decent service. The police station's too far away to head for on foot, especially if the guy who destroyed her windshield has called for help. She had good luck against two of these guys. Against four or five? She'd need more than this impossible strength.
There's only one place she can go right now. Home. If more bikers are on the way, better to face them from behind her security system, with her guns and some chance of repairing her phone line. Besides, maybe they'll never find her house. In the emergency kit in her escape, she finds a flashlight. On the other side of the wrecked car, she finds the Beretta. Home is the only place she can go, she realizes. A few minutes after she reaches the road, her flashlight beam finds the other biker's legs. Once she runs it up his body, she sees his waist is twisted at a grotesque angle from the rest of him, his head a mound of gore. No way did he manage to call for help. The desert is ghostly quiet. She starts in the direction of her house. After a few seconds, she begins to run. She's afraid too much exertion might flush from her system whatever insane combination of hormones is giving her this strength. But she'd rather take that risk than meet more bikers out here in the dark. 9. As the door descends behind her, Charlotte uses the keypad inside the garage to search her security system's recent history. Somehow, Jason managed to crack her code. The proof's right in front of her. System entry 5:36 p.m. Automatic re-engagement happened 3 minutes after. Next comes her arrival, 2 hours later, followed by her departure 20 minutes after that. 20 minutes. Jason's attack, overpowering him, binding him. Was that really all it took? She draws her Beretta. The metal depresses under her grip before she softens her hand. Bedrooms, closets, bathrooms, all empty. Not the kitchen. Jason's still trussed up like a pig, but he's managed to squirm away from the debris left by their struggle in the living room. Exhaustion or pain from his injuries has overtaken him. He's ragdoll limp, but he's definitely alive. When he sees her coming down the hallway, his eyes widen, then narrow when he realizes she's alone. Something uncurls in her at the sight of him. Something hungry and feral and ready to strike. When she's a few steps away from him, he whines into the duct tape across his mouth, starts wiggling backward in a desperate attempt to escape. He seems to be remembering what she's capable of. It's good to be reminded because there were a few moments during the strange, silent trek back to her house when she thought her night so far might have been one giant hallucination. And what causes hallucinations? Drugs. Drugs like the one she's on now. The one Dylan gave her. But Jason's fear is too real to be a hallucination. If this truly is all some giant drug reaction, it sure as hell isn't the kind they warn you about on TV commercials. She reminds herself what she came here to do. A phone. I need a phone. She checks to make sure the base station for her phone system is in its usual spot, on a table in the hallway, just by the entrance to the kitchen. It is. There's even a handset in the cradle, but when she traces the cord down to the outlet, she sees that it's dangling inches from a new hole in the wall. Jason removed the entire socket. Even if she could find it, she'd need a technician to plug it back in and rewire it. He didn't just cut the cord. He didn't just unplug the phone. He made sure there was no way she could easily reconnect if a struggle went in her favor. And if the landline's out, that means no using the alarm's panic button to summon the Scarlet PD, who are 40 minutes away at best. She checks out the outlet in her bedroom. It's in the exact same condition. Her pulse roars in her ears. She's afraid again, but for entirely different reasons. What scares her now is that the pathetic sounds Jason's making when she returns to the kitchen don't inspire revulsion, much less pity. Instead, they seem like information.
The way a caribou's limp is information to a hungry wolf. Is this the drug, too? She thinks. Is it giving me more than just strength? Is it silencing my soul, removing my remorse? Or does remorse always leave you once you have the power to indulge your worst instincts with impunity? As gently as she can, she grips him by one shoulder and pulls him away from the cabinet until he's lying flat on the floor. She gazes into his eyes, studies the fear there. She's savoring it. There's no other word for it. And he can see this, and it terrifies him more. For the first time in months, she tries to summon memories of her grandmother. Her grief made the effort too painful before. But in this moment, it's Luann's voice she needs more than any other. She needs some of the wisdom the woman acquired during the years she spent not knowing what had become of her daughter and granddaughter. Without Luann's moral clarity, Charlotte might do something terrible. Something that can't be reversed. Something that will haunt her long after she finds a way to understand just what the fuck is happening to her body right now. When we hurt people just to punish them, Luann used to say, we create a darkness that will live on long after our reasons for giving birth to it have faded. A phone, she reminds herself. What I need is a phone. I don't need to see Jason Briffle suffer. I just need a goddamn phone. In each hand, she gently grips the tops of his front pockets. Then, with almost no effort, she peels the flaps away from their stitching until both pockets have been unbutterflied. As the stitches rip, tears sprout from Jason's eyes. There's nothing painful about the process. It's the sound of it, she figures. Maybe it makes him imagine his flesh being flayed from his bones. Poor baby. His keyring slides out from one opened pocket. The chunky fob for a Honda hits the floor with a light thud, but no cell phone. She reaches for the tape across his mouth, pokes through the middle of it with one thumb. A tiny gesture, but it makes a pop like smacking gum. Suddenly Jason's breath starts whistling through the fresh hole. Slowly and carefully dragging both index fingers in opposite directions, she turns the hole a slit. Under normal circumstances, this would have required a knife. Right now, she barely has to exert any pressure at all. Where's your phone, asshole? She wants to say. But what comes out of her mouth is, what were you going to do to me, Jason? Please. Please what? What did you come here for? His phone, she thinks. Just get his phone. I told you, he whispers. I came to set you free. With rope and duct tape and my guns? You really believe that? You really think I'll be your Abigail, that I'll find you women to rape and then murder them for you? Why is it so hard for you to see that people care about you, Trina? That is not my fucking name anymore, you sick, crazy shit. At first she thinks he's crying out because he's afraid, or because she's brought her nose to his and rage quaked in every syllable she just snarled. Then she feels something crunch in her hand. It's his right shoulder. She grabbed it without realizing it. She's broken it. The sounds he makes now are more barking dog than sniveling child. Her hand feels hot. Shame clogs her throat. Before she can stop herself, she's skittering backward until she slams into the wall behind her. For a second, she thinks she paralyzed herself. Then she realizes the back of her skull punched into the wall on impact. It takes her a few seconds to pull it free. When she steps forward, plaster chips tumble down her back. Why? How could she watch what happened to those bikers as if it were just a movie, but the sound of Jason's agony threatens to send her into a panic? What brought her remorse back now? Maybe it's because Jason isn't holding a sawed-off shotgun and calling her a cunt. Yes, he came to do her harm, but he's not capable of it right now. And she just broke his shoulder in the blink of an eye. Without meaning to. And that means it wasn't self-defense. It was torture. And how will torture save her from this night? What will it do other than take her back to the Bannings' farm in her mind? So, her soul isn't dead. Whatever's happening inside her body, she's still human. She can feel shame and revulsion, even moments after savoring his fear. This is a good thing, she realizes. Then for the first time she notices the slender gold chain around Jason's neck. Inside the tiny medallion are attached the stylized, painterly outlines of several flames. Flames for burning girl, she thinks. It's a goddamn token celebrating the fact that together she and Abigail Banning burned the belongings of a dozen raped and murdered women. And this fucker wears it on his neck. To see her. Suddenly his agonized wails don't make her feel so ashamed anymore. "Where's your phone?" she asks. He answers with sobs. Slowly she lifts one foot and hovers it over the center of his chest. It's justified, she thinks. It's justified because she needs information. She needs help. "Where is your goddamn cell phone?"
My car. It's in my car, in the Arroyo.
About 15 minutes later, after grabbing a holster for her Beretta and attaching it to her hip, her flashlight beam finds the edge of the Arroyo, then glints off a windshield at its bottom. She hits the key fob. Headlights flash and a car horn bleats, a combo that seems both absurd and somehow hopeless out here in the desolate darkness. It's a Honda Civic, black. The doors caked in sand from days of desert driving. She's about to descend the slope when she hears a sound like buzzsaws approaching through the night. They're coming from the north, from the direction of Fisher Pit. On the horizon, headlights widen like bioluminescent fish emerging from the deep. Motorcycles. 8 of them in all. There's no chance these new bikers can see her way out here. The house sits between her and the highway. Still, she doesn't want to risk being spotted, so she gets down on all fours and slides backward until most of her body is hidden. She can still see across the cactus-studded earth. One after the other, the bikers zip past her house, headed south, toward the scene of bloodshed she'd left behind earlier. Did one of those guys manage to go off in a distress call before he became Cheeseburger? Or is the rest of their crew checking in on schedule? What will they do once they find those bodies? Fan out in search of anyone in the area? Will that bring them to her door? There's not much inside Jason's car, but she does find a cell phone sitting inside the cup holder next to the gear shift. He probably left it because he didn't want to run the risk of it ringing or buzzing or lighting up while he was lying in wait for her. It's a cheap disposable. It's got plenty of juice. She turns it over in her hands slowly and delicately, as if it were made of crystal. After several deep breaths, she starts searching its menu options with the gentlest of button presses. The contact book is empty. So's the call history. There's only one text thread, and it's between Jason and an unidentified phone number. The day before, Jason texted, "Hi, Savior, it's Jay, new phone, leaving now." The response? "Email when you reach Flagstaff." Jason, "Can't email, switched to a disposable phone, only text and call." The response? "Smart. Text when you reach Flagstaff, no calls." He'd done exactly that at about 11 o'clock the night before. Then that morning, he'd texted again. "Getting ready for the last leg. All good?" The response? "Everything's good. We'll let you know if her schedule changes." Her heart hammers. So whoever this savior person is, they've been watching her throughout the day. Longer than that if they knew she was out here. Where were they now? Why hadn't they come to Jason's rescue? The next turns her stomach. It's from Jason. Code is 1986474. Thanks for the tips. What could that even mean? Thanks for the tips. Aside from the fact that whoever this fucker is, he's got the alarm code to her house now, too. Call the police, she tells herself. But just thinking these words reminds her of her one trip to the Scarlet Police Station to register her alarm system. Two deputies, a dispatch officer, and a weary-looking sheriff, none of whom seemed ready for a short jog, much less a biker gun battle. And whoever's helping Jason, their phone number's right here. If they come out now, maybe she'll be able to deal with them as effectively as she's dealt with Jason. Whoever they are, they've lost the element of surprise. Jason texted once more. I hope I'll make you proud. Jesus, she whispers. Proud. What could Jason have planned to do to her in her own house that would make this monster proud? Later, around evening time, the savior texted, she's on her way back. The text was sent at almost the exact time she left Dylan. She scans her memory for any lurkers outside his office. The bikers, maybe. Were the bikers a part of Jason's plan? Did that even make sense? She dials the number. There's an answer after three rings. I said no calls. The breath doesn't leave her. Instead, it's as if the air inside her lungs simply ceases to exist. Like the last breath she took was some childish idea she was foolish to put faith in. She wants to say his name, but now she wonders if it even is his name. If anything he's told her about himself is true. If a single word he shared in that cramped second-floor office that smelled of coffee from the AA meetings downstairs was anything more than a prelude to this night. You're the savior, she hears herself say. Charlie, you told Jason where I lived. You helped him break into my house. Charlie, I need you to listen to— Go to hell! I need you to tell me how you're feeling. Are you kidding? Are you fucking kidding me? You're gonna try to be my therapist now? Cool as ice, Dylan says, No. I want you to describe what you're feeling physically. I don't know if you've been injured, but my guess is that if you're alive, you haven't been. So please, Charlie, tell me how you're— You drugged me. You gave me a goddamn Valium and sent me home to be raped in my own house by that sick fuck. No. No, Charlie, I didn't. That's not what Zapraxin does. Who are you? Just take a deep breath and tell me what you've done, Charlie. Tell me if you can believe what you've done with your own two hands. At first, she thinks he's accusing her of something, but there's wonder in his tone, as if the fact that they are talking to each other at all in this moment is a magical thing. Nothing about him sounds guilty or even hostile. Instead, he sounds animated by a higher purpose. He knows. He knows that she's capable of crushing metal in one hand. That she can throw a grown man several feet in the air. That she can snap bone without meaning to. What did you give me? She asks. What the fuck are these pills? A miracle. You on Zapraxin is a miracle. I saw what you did to those two bikers, Charlie. You're the first person it's ever worked on. Those two bikers. How long has he been following her? Trust me, I didn't want it to happen this way, but— You helped Jason find me and break into my house! What was the point of our sessions? Just to figure out what kind of security I had? You needed a trigger. Charlie, please,
Listen to me. I'll take care of Jason, and I'll explain everything. But you have to trust me. This is bigger than you.
A trigger? What the hell does that mean? Are you completely insane? What did you give me?
I took the power you tried to derive from your guns and your security system and your walls, and I put it in your bare hands. I put it in your bones. That's what I gave you, Charlotte Rowe.
There's a confidence she's never heard in his voice before.
That's what Zapraxin is. It literally converts your fear into strength, into survival. That's what you did tonight, Charlie. You survived. And no matter what happened with Jason inside that house, you have nothing to be ashamed of. There is never shame in surviving.
She's still searching for a response when she hears a strangely familiar sound. Familiar because she heard it only moments before, but now it's coming through the phone at her ear. The bikers.
Shit,
Dylan whispers. He sounds annoyed, irritated. He doesn't sound like a normal man would if a gang of outlaw bikers were suddenly bearing down on him as he stood over the gory corpses of their slain brethren.
Charlie, I know it's hard to trust me right now, but believe me when I say this was not my plan. Our biker friends are an added complication I didn't expect. But I need you to listen to me, and I need you to do what I say.
Go to hell, she whispers.
You're angry. I understand.
His condescension infuriates her. She has to remind herself to keep her hand relaxed so she doesn't crush her only connection to him.
But know this. You're not going to the police, and you're not going to the FBI, and you're not going to Rolling Stone magazine. The people I work for will make sure they never believe what you say and never act on it if they do. And you don't need their help, so why bother?
You're threatening me? How many are there, Charlie?
The bikers? This new crew, they must have driven by your place first. How many are there?
A lot.
Okay. One more thing. Do not, under any circumstances, give Zapraxin to anyone else.
What?
Why? Because you're the first person to take it and live.
You son of a bitch. You crazy son of a bitch! I didn't know what I was really taking!
I know. I know. It's a lot. Don't try to process it all right now. We'll have time, I promise.
There's that tone again. That steady, confident tone. The bikers are getting closer, and he sounds cool as a cucumber, even as he reveals the extent to which he's placed her life at risk. Did he actually just sigh?
Charlie, I have to go and take care of these guys, but there's something I need for you to do for me first.
What?
Run.
He hangs up. She tries calling him back. Once. Twice. Three times. He doesn't answer. It's a miracle. That's what's coursing through her veins now, a miracle. And it wasn't just put there by someone pretending to be a therapist. It was put there by something bigger than her. Months. That's how long she and Dylan spent together in that office. Months. He's had months to plan for this night. For all she knows, he played a hand in bringing the Savage Woods films to the local movie house to trigger her anxiety and create a pretext for forcing the drug on her. And then there's the kiss. The strange, last-minute and inappropriate kiss he gave her right before she left the office. So she would be distracted on the drive home. Because he took my cell phone, she realizes. He took my phone so I wouldn't know someone had disarmed my alarm system. And now he knows my code, so I'm not safe from him if I go back in the house. If the phone and internet are still out, I won't be able to reset the password because it won't be able to connect to the security company's network.
But this is only the half of it, she knows.
If she goes back in the house and if he tries to come for her, even if he just tries to explain his crazy again, something far worse will happen. She'll kill him. She's sure of it. The sense of betrayal sings through her over and over again like lashes from a whip, far more painful and infuriating than her revulsion at being face to face with Jason's dangerous delusions. If she looks into those eyes right now, those same eyes that held her in a consistent and steady gaze meant to earn her confidence, she just might use whatever this strength is to tear them out of his head. Maybe he knows this. Maybe it's why he told her to run. So maybe she shouldn't. Maybe if he manages to escape the latest onslaught of bikers, she should let the son of a bitch pay her a visit so he can feel the full force of whatever he drugged her with. But Jason's agonized wails still play in her ears. What kind of awful music would tearing Dylan, whoever the fuck he is, limb from limb leave on a constant playback in her mind? Amid this din of rage and confusion is another, clearer thought that rises above the clamor. Drugs don't last forever. She starts the Civic's engine, angles it up and out of the arroyo, kills the headlights so she can roll slowly toward the highway under the cover of darkness. But when she reaches the edge of the blacktop, she freezes. South is Scarlet, and the Scarlet Police Station with its four employees, none of whom seem capable of protecting her from anything bigger than a bobcat. South is also the scene of whatever fight's about to break out between a supposed Harvard-educated psychiatrist and a bunch of cranked-up outlaw bikers. He's not just a psychiatrist, she thinks. The guy he pretended to be would not look at a gang of bikers barreling toward him and say, "I have to go and take care of these guys," like he was getting ready to feed a parking meter. And he said he'd take care of Jason, too. What's he going to do, break Jason's other shoulder or break his neck? Do I care which? The rope, remember? The rope and the tape, it was all for me. North, on the other hand, is a whole lot of nothing until Interstate 40, which will give her a new choice, east or west. She tells herself she's waiting to make a decision because more bikers might come flying past. But there's no sign of anything on the northern horizon. She's waiting because she's paralyzed. Amazing to realize that despite her incredible strength, her muscles can still be seized by self-doubt. She hears what comes next before she sees it. A crack that sounds small and thunderous at the same time. Two things that contradict each other. When she looks south, she sees a column of white flame shooting up into the night sky. It's a good distance away. About as far, she guesses, as the scene where the bikers ran her off the road. Whatever its source, the explosion is a single event. It's precise. It's big. And even though she's very far away, she can see pieces of debris inside it. She lets her foot off the brake, turns the Civic north, and gives it as much gas as she can without destroying the pedal. North. It's the only thought she can manage. Go north. And then possibly west, toward California, the only state she's ever really called home. But when she tries to think any further ahead than that, her breaths grow shallow and her vision starts to shrink, so she just keeps saying it to herself over and over again. North, north, north. A daze comes over her. She thinks it might be shock, but it doesn't seem to affect her ability to drive, so what does it matter, really? She's not sure exactly how much time has passed when she realizes she's forgotten to keep her grip on the steering wheel feather light. Her knuckles look white in the dashboard's glow, but the steering wheel's intact. Slowly, she eases her foot down onto the brake, pulls over to the side of the empty road. She steps from the car, walks into the headlights, and picks up a jagged rock that's about the size of a newborn baby. It's heavy and lifting it hurts her arm. Which, in a normal world, is how it should be. When she tries to throw it with one hand, it slips and crashes to the asphalt. Her wrist sings with pain from the effort. Whatever Dylan's miracle provided, it's over now. The strength is gone. And now, with the fears of an ordinary woman, she's looking out into the vast emptiness where the shadows of jagged rocks and cacti are slowly resolving underneath a star-crazed sky. She doesn't have to be careful now as she reaches into her pocket and removes the cardboard packet. Two of the remaining pills have been reduced to orange powder inside their plastic bubbles. Another's been cracked in half. The fourth and fifth are intact. You're the first one to take it and live. She places the pills back inside her pocket and slides behind the wheel. The Beretta's on the seat next to her. Facts, figures, short-term goals. These are her salvation right now. She checks the phone. 3 hours. That's about how much time has elapsed between her first fight with Jason, the emergence of her miraculous strength, and this moment when it left her abruptly and without fanfare. How could it have been only 3 hours? It feels like a lifetime. She starts the car, eases back onto the highway. North, she tells herself again, just as the tears start. North, she tells herself, as her hands start to shake in a way that's all too human, all too normal, all too frightened. Then she remembers she's got 5 pills left, and the fear gradually starts to recede until her hands go still. 10. Before she reaches I-40, Charlotte pulls over to the side of the road and makes a call she should have made hours before. A call that will determine in which direction she heads now, east or west. Kayla answers after one ring. The same woman Dylan dismissed as being undeserving of the title of Charlotte's only friend. Despite the fact that she won the case against Charlotte's dad and routinely battles wealthy wife-beaters and corporations that poison entire communities. The minute Kayla says her name, not her birth name, but the name she chose for herself, Charlotte feels a sudden hot sheen of tears in her eyes. She speaks through a lump in her throat. I need to meet. Someplace safe. Outside San Francisco. Wherever it is, make sure you're not being followed. Media? Kayla asks. No. Your dad? I don't think so.
Jason Briffle?
Yeah, Charlotte answers. It's bad. The incompleteness of the answer feels like a lie. Where are you? Kayla asks. Nowhere. Making a decision where to go next. Whose number is this? Don't ask. Whatever's happening, you know you can trust me, right? Kayla says. Why do you think I called? The problem is I don't actually know what's happening.
Well, all right, where are you now?
Near Flagstaff. Are you in your car?
No.
But you have a car.
Yes.
Come to California. Once you hit the 5, go north like you're going to San Francisco. You're going to meet me in Patterson. It's south of the 580 split. When you get there, go east on Del Puerto Canyon Road, and in about 2 blocks, you'll see a giant Amazon fulfillment center. I'll meet you in the parking lot. Describe the car you're driving.
She does.
Okay. Pretty nondescript. I'll come in slow so you don't miss me.
No, I'm glad it's nondescript, 'cause you're gonna leave it there and come with me.
I don't want to go into the city right now.
I understand. That's why I'm taking you to one of our safe houses. We put high-value witnesses who get threats there if law enforcement won't step up.
Good. That's real good, thank you. I can't... Thank...
Charlie, drive now, feelings later, okay? I'll see you in a few hours. Drive now,
Feelings later, she says to herself as she hangs up the phone. Part 2. 11.
Can we maybe do something about the glare?
Cole Graydon isn't sure who asked this question. He's one of 7 people seated around the executive conference room's frosted glass table. The others include 3 members of his company's legal team, the director of marketing, the chairman of his board, and Dr. Nora Suvari, head of gastrointestinal treatments for Graydon Pharmaceuticals.
It had to have been Nora, he realizes. She's the only one looking at him and not the 80-inch LCD screen at the front of the room. Up until a few seconds ago, she was doing a pretty good job of pretending to watch the final edit of this idiotic video they've gathered to approve.
A better job than he was, that's for sure.
For most of the presentation, he's been looking out the window at a group of kayakers down in La Jolla Bay. Their tiny yellow oars wink in the sun. Their kayaks are bright red, making them look like bits of shark bait determined to avoid their fate. Will they manage a full loop around the bay before the video ends? That this is the question occupying his mind on the eve of their biggest drug launch in 3 years? Well, it won't be the first secret he's kept since taking the reins of his late father's company. But Nora's question and her vacant stare makes it clear he's not the only one bored stiff. The glare to which she just referred is falling across the screen of her iPad, not the screen at the front of the room. When she catches him looking, she closes a Pinterest page and quickly replaces it with the first projection spreadsheet she can open. He fights the urge to cackle. Instead, he hits a button on the remote control next to his laptop. The wall of glass to his left darkens. The view's still there, but now it looks shadowy and slightly unreal. He owes his life to that view. Maybe not his life. Maybe just his sanity. The compact skyline of La Jolla's village and the flower garland of mansions that crown the bluffs overlooking the bay have offered him countless mental escapes from the soul-crushing responsibilities of running this company, most of which bear down on him in this gleaming, glass-filled room. He should chide Nora. He knows it. Call her out for pinning wedding dresses when they should be perfecting every detail of one of the most expensive launches in their company's history. He's pretty sure that's why the chairman of the board, Tucker Albright, is giving him a long look now. If Cole stays silent, Tucker will no doubt report this exchange to Cole's mother, who may well see it as cause to hop in her hired car and be chauffeured down from her horse ranch in Rancho Santa Fe just to see how Cole is handling everything. Which, after some prodding, she'll admit is code for, "I'm here to find out whether or not you're about to run our family's company into the ground again." He's not going to upbraid Nora. Not now, not later. She's a Harvard PhD who came to Graydon with dreams of eradicating stomach-eating parasites in developing nations. Today, she's responsible for a piece-of-shit heartburn drug they're about to market as the only thing that will keep America's stomachs from exploding. "I know, Nora," he thinks. "I had big dreams, too." Tucker Albright, on the other hand, is one of the country's wealthiest beef distributors, whose only qualification for running Graydon's board is that he's chummy with Cole's mother. But he's still studying Cole with icy focus, so Cole gives the man a warm smile. Tucker nods and returns his attention to the giant television screen. Caught, Cole has no choice but to watch the video. Again. For the 100th time. On screen, an actress, whose last big role involved getting devoured by man-eating slugs in a gas station bathroom, sits under dramatic lighting that would better serve an interview with a Syrian refugee. The music is like Chopin on laudanum. The actress is describing,
in a tone more appropriate to the recounting of a violent sexual assault. How heartburn has taken over her life. How she no longer enjoys food. How eating became a source of constant fear and worry. There's a shot of her standing outside the window of a New York deli, staring at the sandwiches inside like an orphan watching a happy family enjoy Christmas dinner. The video is one of several that we'll post to a website scheduled to launch next week, www.enjoyfoodagain.com. While the site will be scrubbed of any obvious clues it's owned and operated by Graydon Pharmaceuticals, more than half of the visitors who flock to it, the ones sharing the most dramatic stories of heartburn-related trauma, will be those hired by a marketing firm with one explicit goal: to convince the people who end up there by chance that they're suffering from a completely bullshit condition that was invented by Graydon's marketing department. RID. Recurrent Intestinal Disrupt. Meanwhile, drug reps for the company, most of them so good-looking they could model swimwear for a living, have already fanned out to doctors' offices all over the country, manipulating every FDA loophole possible to present their new drug, Sunatrex, as a revolution in heartburn treatment, even though there's no evidence to suggest it's any better than Nexium, which anyone who reads a newspaper knows isn't much better than Prilosec. So far, the process has unfolded without a hitch, in meetings much like this one, while Cole stares out the sea-facing glass wall, wondering what's become of his ambitions and his father's legacy. A legacy that includes inventing a drug that revolutionized the treatment of HIV throughout the world. He's killed the sound on his phone, so when the email arrives, it sends a text alert to the lock screen. Once he's sure Tucker isn't watching him, he unlocks it. He doesn't recognize the address. There's a video attached, so he's about to send it to his junk folder. Then he sees the subject line: "Dream big or die in your sleep." This parody of one of his father's favorite and most obnoxious personal expressions, "dream big or go home," is an inside joke. A very inside joke. And the man he shares this joke with hasn't contacted him in almost 3 years. Reading it now makes his stomach feel like he just swallowed a mouthful of ice in one gulp. He checks once again to make sure the sound's off. Then he downloads the video. At first he's not clear what he's watching. The contrast between the depressing piano music from the Sunatrex video and the frenzied images on his phone makes him seasick. Dust, tires, the outline of a speeding SUV. Whatever this is, it's footage taken by a small camera, probably a GoPro, mounted to the front of a motorcycle. He thinks it's a motorcycle, because the other two vehicles in the frame are motorcycles. Their combined headlights light the scene with startling clarity. When the SUV takes out one of them, sending the driver flying over its roof, Cole jumps in his seat. It draws Nora's attention, but not Tucker's, thank God, and she gives him a sympathetic smile. The SUV careens into open desert. One of the other bikers pursues it ahead of the camera-mounted one. The SUV's lost to darkness for a few seconds, then the bike's headlight finds it just as it slams into a giant saguaro, an impact that crushes its nose, dents its hood. Then the door falls off. No, that's not right, he realizes. The driver's side door seems to float off. Which is impossible, but that's how it looks. The driver pushed the door directly out from the side of the SUV with one hand, as if it weighed nothing, then dropped it to the rock-strewn dirt. The guy driving the bike the camera's mounted to enters the frame, the angle going suddenly still now that he's parked. He pulls a sawed-off shotgun from his back, while his hulking, blonde-haired friend approaches the driver with a pair of plastic flex cuffs in hand. The driver is a woman, Cole sees, average-looking, with straw-colored hair and a face made youthful by curves. And even though her face betrays no fear, She is sinking to her knees. Without sound, it's impossible to tell what the blonde guy is shouting at her. But when he grabs her by the hair, Cole sees the woman's expression for the first time. She's not afraid. He's so riveted by what happens next, he forgets he's not alone. The stuttering groan that comes from him when the big biker gets a hole blown through his chest draws the attention of everyone in the conference room. Only then does he realize the videos held him in such thrall, he's risen from his seat and turned his back on all of them. They've stopped the commercial, and their expressions range from puzzled to annoyed.
I need to step out for a minute, folks, he hears himself say.
There's a grumbled objection from Tucker, an envious expression from Nora, and silence from the three lawyers, whose names he's already forgotten. His head of marketing is refilling his coffee from the station in the corner. Cole doesn't notice their reactions as he strides out of the room, then down the hall toward his office. His employees part before him. Maybe it's the expression on his face, or maybe it's that he's their boss. By then, he's read the line of text above the video, the one he missed in his rush to open the file, and his heart has started hammering. New trial going well. When can we discuss the preliminary results? D. 12. The last time Charlotte saw Kayla LeBlanc in person, her hair was a shiny bob, as corporate-looking as the pantsuits she always wore to the office and to court. Now she sports a classic high bun with a twist, and while it's clear she's tried to dress casual, her jeans look like they cost more than Charlotte earns in 6 months. Maybe she's been springing for pricier duds ever since the California Association of Black Lawyers named her Lawyer of the Year. Whatever the reason, she looks way more out of place in this so-called safe house than Charlotte does. Charlotte finds that comforting. It's a sign neither of them really belongs here, which is a sign they won't have to stay for very long. They sit across from each other at the tiny kitchen table. They got there just before dawn after ditching Jason's car at the Amazon Fulfillment Center. And even though she hasn't slept and is subsisting on instant coffee, the only thing in the safe house's kitchen cabinet, Charlotte doesn't feel remotely tired. Outside, peeling paint and a rusty chain-link fence allow the one-story tract home to blend in with its neighbors. Inside, it's scrubbed spotless, barely lived in, and studded with clean, anonymous-looking furniture that belongs in the lobby of a Holiday Inn Express. Charlotte's lost count of how many times she's told the story. Each time, though, Kayla has stopped her at various intervals to ask prodding, detail-oriented questions, the same way she'd prep one of her own witnesses to testify. Kayla holds Charlotte's upturned right hand in both of hers, studying the light bruising along her wrist. A result of the car accident, Charlotte's sure. But maybe it came from her fight with Jason.
"How many days ago did you get this?" Kayla asks.
"It's a few hours old," Charlotte answers. "And it looked 10 times worse right before I met you." Kayla goes rigid. Looks up from Charlotte's hand with an expression that combines fear and disbelief. "You don't believe me," Charlotte finally says.
"I wouldn't say that."
"What would you say?"
"I definitely think you were drugged."
"So you think I hallucinated everything?"
"Part of it, maybe. I mean, the bikers... There's nothing on the news about an explosion."
"It's only been a few hours. Almost no one drives that road. That's why I lived out there. There's no regular truck traffic. The mine's been closed for years. There's no reason anyone would find it right away."
"So you think the guy with the shotgun called for backup before they drove you off the road, and that's who came from the direction of the mine? And that's who this Dylan character met up with before... boom?"
"Something like that, yeah."
"Describe the explosion again."
"I don't... I'm not an explosives expert, but it wasn't messy, if that makes sense. Whatever it was, I think Dylan said it. It wasn't a result of a gunfight. It happened too quickly for that. The other thing, though, it was the way he said it.
Said what?
I need to take care of these guys. Like it was nothing. Outlaw bikers riding straight for him hopped up on God knows what, and he's as cool as ice. He said he'd take care of Jason, too.
And what do we think that means?
Well, he killed all those bikers for getting in the way of his plan. How's he going to treat someone who's no longer useful to him? Someone he manipulated into doing his bidding.
You're sure he was out there when you called him?
I mean, how do you know he was right where those bikers drove you off the road?
I could hear the second group through the phone. They were driving toward him. They must have been going to check on their hideout, and he was there.
So he follows you, he watches what happens with these guys who drove you off the road, and then he just stays out there?
Maybe he was cleaning up.
The bodies, you mean?
Yeah. Why would he do that? Kayla, don't you get it? I'm his test subject. He set the whole thing up. The clearest thing about this drug is that it turns my fear into strength. In order to see if it worked on me, he had to scare the shit out of me. And what better way to do that than to show Jason Briffle how to get inside my house?
Jesus. Who is this guy?
Kayla whispers. So you don't think I was hallucinating him, at least?
I don't think you hallucinated most of it, Charlie. I think Dylan's real. I think he lured Jason out there so you'd have a run-in with him. I even think to some degree the bikers are real. I think this guy gave you something that made you believe you were doing these terrible things, but...
Terrible? Charlotte asks.
Come on, you know what I mean.
Jason was probably going to rape me in my own house. And those bikers? They were going to do worse. A lot worse.
I understand.
But you think what I did was terrible. No, wait. Moot point, you don't really think I did it.
I think your perception was altered. Chemically, look, you're absolutely a victim here, but...
So you don't believe me? You don't believe anything I've told you?
I said I think it's more complicated than what either of us can see. Look, I want you to get some sleep. Kayla gets to her feet. I'm here for you all day.
All night, if need be. I'm not going anywhere.
But you need to get some rest.
I'm not tired.
You're exhausted. Your mind just doesn't know it.
Kayla takes her by the hand and pulls her out of her chair.
Come on.
She leads her toward the hallway.
No,
Charlie says.
No bedroom. Sofa. I don't want to be alone.
Fine. Compromises are good, so long as you at least pretend to sleep.
With one arm around her shoulders, she guides Charlie to the sofa.
I'm going to make some calls. And I'm gonna do it in the other room. But I won't let you out of my sight. I'm not going anywhere, I promise.
Calls? As soon as she stretches out, the sofa envelops her in its cushions. It's hardly the most comfortable sofa she's ever experienced, but it feels delicious. As delicious as a mediocre meal might feel after you've starved yourself all day.
Who are you going to call?
I'm going to try to find out who this guy is, for one. And then...
You aren't going to believe me until something about those bikers hits the news, are you?
There you go. Eyes already drifting shut. See? Told you were tired.
Kayla's right. But Charlotte still has enough energy to reach out and grab her hand before she can withdraw. Kayla,
be careful.
I'm not going anywhere.
No, when you check out Dylan. He said whatever this is, it's bigger than us. Whatever the hell that means. Charlie, my firm takes on some of the most powerful corporations in the world. You can trust our research department, I promise you.
Kayla pats her forehead gently, and Charlotte feels as if she's wrapped in gauze. Before Kayla's footsteps enter the kitchen, sleep rises to consider.